A quick note before we start today's show. You may have heard that President Trump has issued an executive order seeking to block all federal funding to NPR. This is the latest in a series of threats to media organizations across the country. Whatever changes this action brings, NPR's commitment to reporting the news without fear or favor will never change. Even as paywalls rise elsewhere, we offer this vital resource to everyone, regardless of their ability to pay. This is a pivotal moment. It's more important than ever that every supporter who can contribute comes together to pitch in as much as they are able. Support the news and programming you and millions rely on by visiting donate.npr.org. And if you already support us via NPR Plus or another means, thank you. Your support means so much to us, now more than ever. You help make NPR shows freely available to everyone. We are proud to do this work for you and with you. Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident.
In a few moments, I will sign a historic executive order instituting reciprocal tariffs on countries throughout the world. Reciprocal, that means they do it to us and we do it to them. Jobs and factories will come roaring back into our country, and you see it happening already.
As you just heard, one of the biggest reasons behind the Trump administration's tariffs is to bring more factory jobs back into our country. And in case you don't know this about me, I'm from Metro Detroit. I grew up in the Rust Belt, and I know firsthand how deeply our country feels the loss of a lot of our manufacturing jobs, and how we still dream about ourselves as a manufacturing superpower. But what does this dream look like for people on both sides of the aisle? Why does factory work seem so central to our politics? And how does the fantasy of bringing it back stack up against the reality of what manufacturing looks like in our country today?
I always imagine Charlie Chaplin in modern times just like cranking one knob on an assembly line. That isn't really a thing anymore.
That's Dylan Matthews, senior correspondent at Vox. I'm joined by him and Jeffrey Gonzalez, associate professor at Montclair State University in New Jersey.
Yeah, thanks for having me too.
So to jump right in, according to one poll from the Cato Institute and YouGov, 80% of Americans want more people working in factories here, but only 25% said they would be better off if they themselves did in fact work in a factory. Why might Americans like the idea of other people working in factories more than the prospect of working in factories themselves?
So this comes up fairly commonly, and I think it's because Americans have this deeply mythological sense of what manufacturing labor is. Mm-hmm. And sometimes this work is dirty, it's hard, people get hurt. And that's really dropped out when politicians talk about manufacturing labor. What they're calling on is mostly this very masculinized sense of history that what manufacturing labor was stable, steady work for men who could bring home a paycheck and take care of their families and were making real things with their hands. I think that the 25% may have bought into or may just want a job that they think will have a good paycheck.
Yeah.
But that the 55% who want it but don't want to do it might remember those elements, that this was hard work, that this was difficult work, and that maybe they don't see themselves in that mythological picture.
Or they already like their jobs or just have different passions. Yeah. But I mean, the lasting legacy of like the idea that a factory job is a good job, it's kind of outlived the actual truth of that situation. Salaries for manufacturing jobs are now in the bottom half of all jobs. And one paper by researchers at the Federal Reserve shows that the decline in unionization rates is by and large responsible for the drop in wages for factory work compared to other jobs.
And that's what I think is interesting about this nostalgic picture that some scholars have called smokestack nostalgia. We have this image of manufacturing work as this reliable form of good-paying labor that forgets that it was union activity that was what secured those. And it was often violent struggle, right? Like in places like Bethlehem, that generated those good wages. Mm. And that what happened to those places, you know, the northern factories where that union work happened, they were undercut by laws in the South that made manufacturing move south, where it was much harder to create a union. Mm. So the picture that we get with smokestack nostalgia is that these were good, solid jobs that people had for generations, when in fact, it was always precarious labor. Your factory could always up and move.
Right.
And if you got hurt or if you got laid off, right, there wasn't the security that the mental picture that I think gets conjured by politicians gives us.
I just wanted to underline what Jeffrey was saying about Southern competition, that I think so much of the narrative here is about competition from Mexico, from Japan and Korea when it comes to cars. And that's real, that played a role. But the U.S. federal system and the fact that you had all these right-to-work states, that was undermining the union wage premium and putting pressure on these firms well before NAFTA.
Right. For those who don't know, right-to-work states are states with laws prohibiting mandatory union membership as a condition of employment. And this makes it harder for unions to organize. Also, NAFTA was the trade agreement we made with Canada and Mexico in the 90s to get rid of tariffs.
Yeah, so it all matters, but it's a story of the U.S. internally as well as about us and other countries.
I think regardless of whether people might want to work in a factory themselves or not, there is a kind of fantasy about factory work happening in our culture, in our politics right now. It's also happening on both sides of the aisle. Like there's a romanticization of labor and laborers on the left in kind of like a Marxist way, but also another flavor of that on the right that's more about like self-sufficiency and tradition and strength. So what is being romanticized here? What do people think more American factories can do for us?
I very much have an email job now. I almost always am on Zoom with sources or phone calls or things.
Right, right, right.
I do have articles, but if you like really think about like what am I doing? It's, well, I'm trying to create page views so that we can sell money to advertisers so they can sell cars.
Yeah.
The whole economic process I am a part of is so baroque and so apart from what it is I'm actually doing day to day that you lose that kind of connection. And I think that's an important emotional thing for some people. I think some people have some guilt about their job sitting behind a computer making more money than their, say, father made in a factory when it seemed like he was doing much more exhausting physical labor. And there's some of this that speaks to insecurities people might have about sort of knowledge sector labor.
Right. And if I can bring up a cultural example.
Go for it.
There's a 2010 movie called Company Men with Ben Affleck and Tommy Lee Jones. And in that movie, you have basically this full-throated sense that manufacturing labor is like a driver of masculine virtue. Mm. The film takes place at this company that went from a manufacturing company to this big multinational that has an insurance arm, it has a finance arm. And what happens throughout the movie is that they all get this fantasy that they're going to like recreate the manufacturing arm of that company. They go to this hangar where they used to make ships. And Tommy Lee Jones has this long monologue where he says there were 6,000 men who made a good wage here every day and put their kids into college.
Building something they could see, not just figures on a balance sheet, but a ship. They could see, smell, and touch. Those men knew their worth. They knew who they were.
And what's so crazy about this monologue is those kids were going to college to not work in that hangar.
Right, right, right.
Right? And again, like the emphasis is on men. And in that movie, the white-collar characters who are resurrecting this manufacturing base, they don't ever do the manufacturing work. And there's not a single manufacturing labor in the movie.
Hmm.
So in some ways, those characters seem to me like J.D. Vance and other people who are pushing this manufacturing idea, where it's in fact a white-collar way of resurrecting your own masculinity.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of wild. It's like this, what, masculinity bypass, basically.
Right.
You don't have to get your hands dirty, but you can be seen as the kind of guy who appreciates getting his hands dirty, and like that by proxy is enough.
Yes. There's this sense that like pushing paper makes you feminine.
Though it does need to be said that women have long been factory workers along with immigrants and people of color and queer people. Butch lesbians were especially associated with blue collar jobs in the mid-century, which included factory work.
I also think We've touched a bit about some of the like conservative mythologies here, that I think the idea of a family wage, that you can make enough money in a factory to pay for the full family, which implicitly means the wife, because they're always talking about straight families, the wife does not have to work. Mm-hmm. I think the nostalgia that you hear on the left about this is different. If you look back at 50s and 60s, the heyday of American manufacturing was also the heyday of American unions. You had a quarter to a third of Americans covered by a collective bargaining agreement. The UAW was incredibly powerful.
Yeah, that's the United Auto Workers Union, for those who don't know.
Exactly. The UAW in turn supported a Democratic Party where labor was an incredibly important part of the coalition. Spending programs like Medicare might not have passed without strong union support. And so I think there's nostalgia for that. And I think it's not an accident that the sort of the manufacturing era and the union era were coterminous. If you were wanting to like invent a place that is useful to unionize, you would invent a factory. These steel mills have many thousands of workers working in the same place in close proximity, doing similar jobs, getting close to each other, and they're talking a lot. That's a very conducive organizing environment.
Okay, I see the fantasy here, but I'm also curious, how did factory work become sort of woven into American identity in the first place? And why is it still there, even if we don't work in factories as much as we used to?
Well, I think if we think back to the great Walt Whitman poem, I Hear America Singing, it's actually about work, right? It's about all these people kind of working and doing things and building things. And so I think that there's a sense that America likes to think of itself as full of hardworking people, and the factory was a place where you had to do hard work. So I think in that way, too, it's kind of folded into American ideology.
I also think I give a lot of credit to the legacy of World War II, that America's role in that war to a large degree was to build the planes and tanks and cars and trucks and munitions that helped our allies in the UK and in the Soviet Union win that war. And we came out of it as the dominant manufacturing power in the world. And yeah, I think that war is very important for how Americans think of ourselves. And manufacturing is a big part of that.
Totally. And now there's that lingering question of who are we without this pillar of our American identity? I'm also thinking about the national security argument for bringing more factories back. Vice President J.D. Vance has talked about this.
For 40 years, we have lost manufacturing capacity. Workers have seen their wages stagnate. And some of the most critical things that we need, from the pharmaceuticals, the drugs that we give to our children, to the weapons that we actually need to fight a war, if God forbid we had to fight a war, we don't make enough of that stuff.
But I also question whether we'd even need to, you know, as we already have over 3,000 nuclear warheads currently stockpiled. Like, say what you will about the American military, but I'm not sure any of the three of us would argue that it's been under-resourced, right? But there's still an idea here that not having as many factories makes us weaker from a national security standpoint.
So I agree with a lot of that. I think if I were to make the national security case for manufacturing as sympathetically as I can, the U.S. has a lot of nuclear weapons, but we've been giving a lot of artillery shells to Ukraine in their battle with Russia, and our ability to produce those has been pretty limited, and we've run through a lot of existing stockpiles. I think some of that was the military shifted in the aughts and the tens to thinking what we're doing is fighting adversaries like Al-Qaeda or ISIS. And so it's not going to be like two armies on a battlefield exchanging artillery fire. But now the Ukraine war is exactly two armies on a battlefield exchanging artillery fire. And our ability to produce things for that is not what it once was. And I think the other thing is the rise of drones, and not just like big drone in the sky dropping a bomb, but things closer to the drones you could buy at Walmart. Like, a surprising amount of the Ukraine war has been both sides using drones like that to do reconnaissance on each other and try to anticipate attacks. And those drones are almost all made in China. There are people in DC who are very convinced that China is a deep adversary. And if this is an important military technology that they make almost all of, I think within that worldview, it makes sense to be a little worried about this. Now, whether you think China's a big adversary and we should be preparing for war against them, that's a bigger question.
Coming up, what does manufacturing actually look like in the U.S.? And could the tariffs help bring more factory jobs back?
The best analogy I've heard for using tariffs to try to get manufacturing jobs back is if you run someone over with your car, and then to fix the situation, you back over them again.
Stick around. I want to talk more about the reality of factory work in the U.S. These jobs, by the way, they already exist.
Right.
As of February, there are 400,000 open positions in manufacturing. I've seen reports that some factory owners are desperate for more workers. I think that might be surprising. You know, there's an image I think that people have of manufacturing as up and leaving completely. And I'll say, you know, being from the Rust Belt and like driving to visit family, you can see, right, that industry has left a lot of these places. I don't think that people are wrong, right, for having the notion that like manufacturing has disappeared. It is a much smaller industry now, but at the end of the day, this is a sector that's still struggling to fill jobs. Why is that?
I do want to underline that what a manufacturing job looks like now looks very different from what it did in the 50s.
Please say more about that. Yeah.
The number of sort of assembly line jobs, I always imagine Charlie Chaplin in Modern Times just like cranking one knob on an assembly line, that isn't really a thing anymore. If you look at the people being hired, these are highly trained engineers with master's and PhDs in electrical engineering who have to run very complex systems. If part of the appeal of manufacturing was that it provided decent wage jobs for people straight out of high school, that is not the way a lot of these factories operate these days. Mm. And I think it also gets at some of the, like, how we define the limits of what manufacturing is. NVIDIA, which is one of the most valuable companies in the world, does not make a single chip. They design chips and they pay other people to make them. And the people doing that design, I think, are in some important sense doing manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of what you're touching on right now, the conditions that are really hitting the manufacturing sector, at least in the United States, a lot of those things you touched on in a piece that you recently wrote in Vox called Manufacturing Jobs Are Never Coming Back. Why can't they?
So I think I don't want to say that manufacturing is never coming back. Manufacturing will always be an important part of the economy. It's just incredibly, incredibly automated. We've had, in many sectors, robust growth in productivity, I think especially computers and computer manufacturing. And growth in productivity for manufacturing has been the main driver of employment loss in the sector. Competition from China played a role. Some policies taken by the U.S. played a role. The main factor was you need fewer workers to make the same amount of stuff. That process has been going on globally, and I think there are a few metrics by which global manufacturing employment, the total number of people in the world who work in manufacturing, has peaked. If global manufacturing employment has peaked, that is not about policy. That is not about trade imbalances. That more or less has to be because of technological changes. So that's why I felt confident saying the share of manufacturing employment in the U.S. is not going to go up again. There's just been a lot of money invested in making humans less essential to the production process.
Bringing things back to the tariffs. Ultimately, what might these tariffs mean for both the fantasy and the reality of factory work?
Just two things here. I think the best analogy I've heard for using tariffs to try to get manufacturing jobs back is if you run someone over with your car, and then to fix the situation, you back over them again. It just doesn't follow that if the U.S. changing its trade policy one way led to this exit of jobs, that reversing that will bring them back. You can't put the toothpaste back in. I think just on the cultural side, I would love for politicians to stand up and say, Amazon warehouse workers need to make more money. Yeah. Like, I want to make that a job that is good the same way that working at a GM line was a good job. Mm. I don't think there's anything magical about manufacturing that means those are good jobs and these aren't. We can make the jobs good if we want them to be good.
I think you're absolutely right, Dylan, that what the fantasy does in some ways is it's to say that if we did X and Y right, then Americans could make good money again, rather than like, why can't Americans make good money now?
Mm. Well, Dylan, Jeffrey, thank you both so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed this conversation.
I really did too. Thanks so much.
Yes, this was great. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dylan Matthews, senior correspondent at Vox, and Jeffrey Gonzalez, associate professor at Montclair State University. And I'm going to put on my influencer hat for a second and ask you to please subscribe to this show on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you're listening. Click follow so you know the latest in culture while it's still hot. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Liam McBain.
Engineering support came from
David Greenberg.
This episode was edited by
Nina Patuck.
Our supervising producer is
Barton Girdwood.
Our executive producer is
Verilyn Williams.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.